Well, back to gravity, I'm going to get to gravity. I mean, the way that we understand gravity in different ways, I mean, different view on gravity emerges from thinking about black holes. I mean, black holes are ideal testing grounds for trying to figure out what gravity is, and in particular the fact that the black hole has a horizon. That's where it reveals, well, that we can understand better what are the microscopic ways of thinking about space-time. For an outside observer, the horizon is a special place. For an observer that falls in, horizon is not a special place. So what we learn about horizons will teach us about space-time in general. So the first people to think about the horizons and the thought experiments that people did were people like Penrose, Christopher Dulu, Bekenstein, Hawking, and maybe I forget a few. But one of the experiments they did was thinking about a particle, lowering it gradually to the horizon on some fictitious string that we attach to the particle, and then extracting energy from the system by allowing some work to be done by the force that acts on the particle. Then if you would be able to lower the particle completely on the horizon, you would have extracted all of the rest energy of that particle, and there would have nothing been left anymore of the information associated to it. That led Bekenstein to think about, modifications of the classical picture. In particular, if you think about a case where you take a box of radiation which has an entropy associated to it, and you would be able to lower that entirely to the horizon of a black hole. I mean, on the horizon of a black hole, all of the energy is being redshifted, so there's no increase in mass if the particles would be really on the horizon. But if there's a slight distance away from it, you will have a slight increase of the mass still. And that's actually what Bekenstein said. Due to quantum uncertainties, you should declare that the particles inside the box are already part of the black hole system when they're sort of one quantum wavelength away from the horizon. Because if you do that, you can calculate that there's a slight increase still in the mass of the black hole. Therefore, the area of the horizon increases. And if we associate that with, one bit of information per particle, then you sort of arrive at the Bekenstein-Hawking area law. So it really came from a heuristic argument where the quantum uncertainty of the position of the particle was needed to see the increase of the area happening. So the particle is not really on the horizon, it's really a slight distance away from it when it's already sort of identified with the degrees of freedom associated with the horizon. So that's where he got his area law from. And of course, we all know that the formula was not just due to him, it was Bekenstein and Hawking. And Hawking, of course, added the fact that the black holes also have temperature. So if you take the Hawking radiation, and I'm sure that in this community, people have seen this many times. The formula for the Hawking radiation can be written in the following way. You can write it in terms of the acceleration at the surface of the horizon just by the Newtonian formula, and then put in the Unruh temperature with a certain acceleration g. And then this is the temperature associated to a black hole. So there's a temperature and an entropy associated to a black hole. The fact that there's a thermodynamic interpretation of black holes, of gravity, was already sort of known in the 70s. But at that time, people thought, that fundamentally means that there's some information maybe lost even in black holes, which, of course, was a whole discussion that went on. Just to mention this, there's already the Unruh effect is the same as sort of a Hawking temperature, except that you can do it also in flat space-time. So what we learn about black hole horizons can also be applied in general in flat space-time. If you just replace the gravitational acceleration by ordinary acceleration A. And just for later reference, there's also a way you can do it in the sitter space. There's also temperature because of horizons in the sitter space. And that's the way we can express it again in the same formula a la Unruh, with some acceleration being related to the cosmological horizon. So anyhow, the notion of temperature and entropy can be applied not just to black hole horizons, also to cosmological horizons and horizons associated with accelerated observers. This is
I think I already said this. Oh yeah, the fact there is a temperature, by the way, that's maybe what I want to say here, is
the fact that there's a temperature has been added to the story of Bekenstein, because what really happens to the particles when they approach the horizon is that they will be there in some thermal environment of the Hawking particles near the horizon. So the particles are being thermalized when they approach the horizon. And they never really cross that, but they sort of become associated with the degrees of freedom of the black hole. And now the whole discussion about black hole thermodynamics led about, well, a few decades in the mid-90s to the idea of holographic principle. And particularly Gerard at Hooft tried to argue that the entropy we associate to a black hole should be given a very specific meaning. He said it really should represent the microscopic degrees of freedom that we can at most associate with a certain part of space. It's a very deep principle in the following sense. I mean, he says that the maximum state of entropy, the state of maximum entropy inside a volume, is a state where you take a black hole and put that inside the volume so that the area of the volume coincides with the horizon. And so the number of bits the maximum number of bits should be equal to the area in Planckian units. Why is this a deep statement? I mean, this tells you you cannot think about space-time as sort of a lattice degree, lattice object, because if you put a lattice and you put degrees of freedom on every lattice side, it will grow like the volume. And so there won't be a way you can describe the holographic principle by a lattice model. It also tells you that information cannot be purely local. I mean, if you think about a big volume, the information which you associate with two parts of the volume, I mean, if you have, how should I say this, the information that's on this screen cannot be associated just with the space inside. If you have two volumes, two with each their area, and you would sort of sum that up, you would still have something that grows like the volume. So the information that is stored on the screen should also be non-local. So having the holographic principles would really be a different way of thinking about organizing one's degrees of freedom. It was sort of a far-fetched idea at that time, but the fact that we in string theory have been able to make contact with it certainly has made it more accepted in our community. So indeed, in string theory we have ADS-CFT, and in ADS-CFT there's a concrete realization of the holographic principle. There we have a theory on the boundary, a field theory whose degrees of freedom are described by Yang-Mills theory, and it's dual to a black hole, to a gravity and the bulk. And the nice thing is that it's a precisely situation where you can reanalyze the thought experiments I just mentioned. So we have a correspondence between a thermal black hole in the bulk and a thermal state on the boundary. Anyhow, I'm sure you have all seen this, but what I want to mention here is indeed that I can do this experiment. So I have a black hole in ADS space, and I know that in ADS CFT, it's dual to a hot conformal field theory on the boundary. And so what is the thought experiment that we want to do? We want to think about this particle being lower to the black hole horizon. The deep thing about ADS CFT is that there are two descriptions, one involving theory with gravity, and then the theory on the boundary, which has no gravity in it. But we still want to describe the same physics. So we want to also describe the physics of the black hole, well, pulling the particle, the gravitational force, how that emerges there. So what is the representation of a particle near the black hole? Since the extra dimension that I've added, so in the ADS-CFT, there's one extra dimension. And that extra dimension, which goes into the bulk, has the interpretation of the scale, a scale in the boundary theory. So things that are moving inside the bulk, they have a certain size on the boundary, and they become bigger on this, in the n equals 4 description. So what a particle is in a black hole situation when it approaches the horizon is some delocalized object, which if you have it close to the horizon becomes thermalized, it sort of thermalizes in the heat bath. And we understand actually indeed in ADS-CFT particles falling into the black hole as objects that are being thermalized on the boundary. But now think about indeed the force that arises. Well, what's the force that's pulling it? There's no interpretation on the boundary because the direction in which the force is acting is not really a coordinate that really, well, we know about on the boundary. So that I'm going to tell you that this force should be given an entropic reasoning or explanation on the boundary. Oh, so here now I'm going to get to the main idea. So in string theory, we have actually learned that there are many more microscopic degrees of freedom to describe our world, and that the microscopic dynamics of those degrees of freedom can be very fast. The associated information, and like in a thermal heat bath, is not visible to us, and also the dynamics to us appears quite random. And so the usual concepts that we think about, like particles and masses and positions, should be thought of as macroscopic variables. But that really, what's associated with them is a finite amount of entropy that's going to be driving the forces. So I'm going to get from this the emergent forces. So I'm going to take ADS-CFT as an example, but we'll see more examples later on. I mean, in ADS-CFT, we have an emergent space direction. So suppose that space is emergent. How can we then understand that gravity emerges? We don't even know this very well in ADS-CFT. And also, if you think about what does it mean to have force in the direction of space-time that is emergent. So what I'm going to argue now is that there's a way you can understand this using entropic arguments if you assume certain assumptions. So one assumption I'm going to take is that the holographic principle is true, which basically means that the information indeed sort of cannot be exceeding the area of a volume, but also that you can think about this information and being stored on screens. I have to make some further assumptions about, well, what is emergent? I mean, time, I'm not going to make emergent. I'm going to assume that time is there because I want to make use of the entropy concept, of the energy concept. So this is the first starting situation. So I think about microscopic degrees of freedom that I can associate with space, but I want to think about them as being stored on a screen. So this part of space is being described by microscopic degrees of freedom on the screen, but therefore we should not sort of duplicate our information. So this part of space has not been emerged yet. It's described in microscopic data. But then I want to have a correspondence with the part of space that I can already think about in usual terms. I call that the emerged space. So you're thinking about this also in the black hole situation as some screen close, say, to the horizon. Then we have this particle close to it, and I want to understand what it means to have a force acting on that particle. No. So I'm already telling you here what I call a metaphor in the following way. I mean, there is a microscopic system that I have where I don't know what coordinates mean yet. So I want to introduce coordinates as macroscopic variables, and then I'm going to study what happens microscopically as a function of those microscopic variables. So the space-time is like the slow variables which I have in the polymer situation, and then the microscopic dynamics is really what would be describing, say, the heat bath of all the position of those particles. So there's some complicated dynamics happening in terms of the microscopics, which a priori has no interpretation in space-time. Space-time is something I want to reformulate the dynamics that's happening microscopically in terms of space-time degrees of freedom.
Is that what you've already made an association with?
That's right. So you want to do this in steps. So, and it's somewhat like coarse graining, so where you want to start from the most local, I mean, the smallest. So there's some way you can split the space into degrees of freedom that already have a space-time interpretation, and those that I want to give still a space-time interpretation. So I'm doing it in steps. It's somewhat like you do in indeed an RG-type situation. And of course, it's motivated also from ADS-CFT, where we know we have a boundary theory which is at infinity. where we can start going in, and we call this holographic renormalization, where we start integrating out certain degrees of freedom that we then give a space-time interpretation. So my reasoning is going to be this small incremental step by which I can move the screen a little bit inward. So if I know, so I start very far, but I would just want to know how I can move this in small steps. And if I know how to do it in a small step, I can do this successively and see how the whole thing would be happening. So I'm going to choose one special direction in which it's going to happen. And one way I can, I know this is how we do this in string theory, but so I want to just give you the general reasoning. So emergence is just simply means here I know what space-time means, but there are degrees of freedom for which I don't know yet what it means. And I want to tell you what is a dictionary that I need from to go from these degrees of freedom to the ones that describe space-time. So there's certain quantities that I can write down here, which I know what they are, like force, positions, velocities, and so on. But I don't know what any mean microscopically. So I'm now going to tell you the heuristic derivation of Newton's law of gravity from this picture. And of course, I'm going to use a starting point similar to what Bekenstein actually used. So I'm thinking about how do I think about space-time? I mean, you can think about them as points, but you cannot localize positions, particles at arbitrary position on a location of a point, because if you have all the digits of the coordinates already with an infinite amount of information. If you have only a finite number of information, points sort of, have a certain fuzzy aspect to it. I mean, that's also what Bekenstein did, but that's sort of a quantum uncertainty. But the information that we have microscopically, you can think about then is stored on a screen, and I just represent it by bits, but that should be indeed seen again as a metaphor of what kind of information. I don't really care about what the information is, only the amount of information is going to be important. The basic assumption is going to be that if the particle moves and it approaches the screen, that there will be a change in the amount of information. And as Bekenstein did, he said, well, if the particle crosses the screen, there will be one bit of information changed, and I call that one bit of information associated with a little change in entropy, delta S, and I just normalize it in such a way with a 2 pi, and it will be clear why I do that. So this is the amount of information that changes when I displace the particle over one quantum wavelength, delta X. If I do that, you can get a force, first step is actually, let me rewrite these two equations together and combine them in one by saying that the amount of information is linear in the displacement. So if I displace the particle over twice that distance, I get 2 times the same change. At least this is in the vicinity of the screen, some linear relation between delta X and delta S. And this is the inverse Compton wavelength. I'm just saying that the direction of increase of entropy is when you go into the screen. Well, if you think about Bekenstein's argument, he has to say that there's one particle being captured. If I have 2 particles close to the screen, both of them would have an increase of the same amount. And if I think about that particle as 1 or 2 particles, should not really make a difference. But what changes is the distance, because the Compton wavelength is a different one. But also the additivity of mass and information is already telling you there should be linear relation here. So, but indeed, what I'm saying is that there is a linear relation, so that even if you pull the particle further out, this is going to happen. Actually, but if you really think about Bekenstein's argument, he had to have this relationship near the black hole horizon, because he didn't really say where he put the screen. Actually, I'll come to that. Makes this also possible.
Yeah, of course.
So this equation I know is true near horizons, and I'll say more about that in a minute. So this equation I know is true for near a horizon. And actually, it follows from Bekenstein's argument. Let me give the proof in a minute for that. But what I'm saying here is it's a heuristic argument which I'm going to get gravity from. And I'll say more about what the validity is in general. So first of all, why did I choose those normalizations? If I take the temperature of the screen, take a temperature on the screen, I can get a force. And it's precisely if you take the Undo temperature that you can get the usual Newton's law out of it from the change of entropy that I wrote down on the previous screen. So then that at least motivates the normalization. So the law of gravity can emerge as follows. You take a screen which is spherically symmetric, you put the energy inside, and you just, well, relate that to a mass by the usual E and C squared. And if you then assume that the number of bits, well, is associated with the number of degrees of freedom, and indeed by calculating the temperature on the screen from some equipartition, well, the number of bits is going to be proportional to the area, and I just determine the temperature by taking the energy divided by the number of bits. Then by putting in the force relation, so between the energy, sorry, difference. So the energy difference can be written as work done F delta X, and you take the change in temperature times, the entropic change times the temperature. If you equate that, you find the usual law of gravity. Anyhow, this is a heuristic argument, and I am ready to admit that the only thing I basically did was reverse the logic of, that led basically to the holographic principle. So I start from the holographic principle now, and then I derive gravity. Well, in the usual way, it goes the other way around. We assume gravity, and then we have a way to get to the holographic principle. But the main idea, and this is sort of where I want to answer some of your questions. I mean, there's a different statement that I make here. It's not just thermodynamics. I want to say that the change in entropy is really what's driving the gravitational force, just like what happens in the polymer example. The change in entropy is really what we need to calculate the magnitude of the force. I know it holds actually near black hole horizon. I'll actually make that clear. But does it hold in more general situations or not? I mean, there are certainly some questions one can ask here. But let me actually make clear why it holds near horizon. So this is a closer examination of the Bekenstein argument. So Bekenstein said there must be a location where I reformulate my degrees of freedom from, say, a particle close to the screen, to the horizon, to where I associated with the degrees of freedom of the black hole. He did not allow to put the particle right on the horizon. So the horizon is here, and there should be a screen slightly away from it. The distance he took to be one quantum wavelength, which is sort of an arbitrary distance, and you don't really know where that distance is. There's not even a preferred choice where you can put it. So the correspondence rules which he made between the location of that particle and where the screen is located and the degrees of freedom of the black hole should be such that this is independent of where I put the screen. There should be certain freedom and where to put it. So if you then work out what that implies, namely if I look at two situations where I take the particle just outside of the screen and just inside, there's a difference. What is the difference? The amount of energy that's associated with the particle is changed, namely applied a certain amount of work. And the only way you can explain that is there's also a change in the entropy of the black hole, and just consistency of black hole thermodynamics implies that you can write the amount of work precisely in this form. And I already told you what the Hawking temperature is, and I told you what the black hole entropy change should be. Anyhow, you will find that these equations are precisely the ones I just wrote down. So these equations hold, and they hold near the horizon of a black hole. What I don't know is whether they hold in general when I go away from horizons. But anyhow, I can still get the laws of gravity by using a similar reasoning. Yes, now, so now I'm actually going to go to a slightly more technical part where I will slightly answer these kind of questions. You know that if you know it's true near the horizon, you would reason that it holds anywhere, because locally I can think about gravity just as being an acceleration. I mean, the equivalence principle that tells us there's no difference. So if I know that this equation holds near the horizon, so why doesn't it hold in general? Could there be modifications still? And actually, I'm going to say there will be a modification. If there's a force, there must be a okay, actually, that's why I mentioned the Born-Oppenheimer situation, because then that's not a usual thermal situation. There's a the temperature there would have said something about the level spacing of what the energy states would look like. But first, let me continue the same arguments that you had, which just were based on dimensional reasonings. I will show later how I can modify them, but in order to understand why they could be modified, so this picture should be thought of as follows. Suppose this is a black hole horizon. So I think about black holes with the family of black holes, and then there are equipotential surfaces of Newton's potential around it. But you can also think about this in terms of redshifts, as will become clear. So the emergence of space, this picture, was something that starts from infinity, where you have screens located precisely at equipotential surfaces. So now I want to use the same reasoning to get the force. And I'll just do it in the most obvious way, by taking the same Undo temperature as my temperature. So I express it as the gradient of Newton's potential. I take the density of my bits the same as I have on the horizon of a black hole. And then you can figure out, again, that the same law that tells a sort of an equipartition law will hold. Because, well, it's basically rewriting of Gauss's law. So it tells me that I have redistributed the energy of the mass inside, basically as energy on the surface. Of course, we can do the same thing with charge as well, because if you have charge inside, we know how to sort of put that as a surface charge and still derive the gravity law. So I've not done a very great deal here. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, how do you talk about potential trying to derive gravity?
So what I'm okay. I have to say this again. I mean, I cannot start from emergent space if there's no starting point. So I have to have a starting point somewhere at infinity. Okay. Now I'm gonna integrate out certain degrees of freedom, and integrate in other degrees of freedom that I represent by space.
Right.
Now, the thing that I want to tell you is how to do the next step.
Right.
If I know the infinitesimal step, I could have started really at infinity and integrated in every step. Mm. I only have to tell you the infinitesimal step, how I integrate out a little bit more, and how I go inward.
So you're saying once you have a potential in some region, then you know how to go to the next one?
That's right.
Okay. All right. That's fair.
So I assume that I know what
potential. So the potential emerges along with space. The potential is emerging.
There's no other way to have space emergent than with the potential. And the reason is that you have to keep track of the amount of information that went into the construction of space-time.
Okay.
And Newton's potential is precisely doing that.
I see. So you,
and because that's a driving mechanism of the force. I mean, there's no way you can describe emergent space without gravity.
Building up as you
so grow. It's not like you have space and then you put gravity on top of it. No, gravity has it emerges together with gravity.
Okay, cool.
And so I know what phi is here, but then I want to sort of make a correspondence between things that I know microscopically. So if you notice, look at the equations that I write down. On the left hand side, there's something I can define here microscopically. On the right hand side are things that I know in space time. So there are correspondence rules between what I mean, the temperature is something I can associate with degrees of freedom on the screen.
So it's just how to push the screen a little bit further.
Then you would know how to push it further. So anyhow, you can then also write the force law, and it's sort of by using the electrostatic analysis, it's quite easy. There is a way you can redistribute the information on the screen, or let's see, change the amount of information on the screen if I move some particles in the neighborhood by writing, well, actually that's precisely what Newton's potential is trying to keep track of. There's some way in which the information on the screen is modified when I change the particle, locations of the particles. By calculating what's the change of Newton's potential due to this change of location of particles. Now, then I have some equation that tells me how to do this on the energy, the entropy density on the screen. Anyhow, there's a way of writing the forces on these particles precisely as a law of thermodynamics, as integral TdS, so delta S is the information density on the screen for the change in it. And that's just the usual work that we do, the virtual work on particles. And it's quite easy to check that it's the formula holds. General relativity can be sort of done in a similar way. I'm not going to go into detail here because I want to go to get to the question about what can be generalized. So the main thing I should have said, I mean, the role of Newton's potential in general relativity is played by the redshift factor. Maybe I should actually draw this. Yeah, it's the same. These are precisely the same equations I had for the Newtonian case, except that what I call phi is a redshift factor. It's the length of a time-like Killing vector. So if I assume that I am in a static background, these are for surfaces then of constant redshift, and then you can reformulate the Newton's of the Einstein equation basically in terms again of a sort of Gauss law. It's called the Gomar mass formula. And you can also figure out how the forces were acting in this case. And now Einstein's equations are consistent with that. But now I want to get to the question about what could be different in the formula. So when I'm not, so you're right actually at the Riemann horizon probably the same formulas would hold. But there's an ambiguity. I mean, in the force, in the arguments I use h bar and I use the speed of light. But eventually the force is expressed in just Newton's constant. So Planck's constant and the speed of light seem to be irrelevant for the argument. I can rescale them by any function or any parameter, I should say, any constant. But I can even rescale them with a function that depends on the redshift factor or on the Newton potential. The reason is I do the arguments on an equipotential surface. Anyhow, I think it makes the argument more robust, but it also makes it clear that there's an ambiguity there which we want to fix. And actually, I have a way of fixing it, which I want to mention, which was not in the paper. So for a Winkler horizon, you can do the following. So I assume there was a change of entropy when I displaced the particle. So this is just a rewriting of the same equation as before, but sort of in a suggestive way. I mean, here I write the gradient of the entropy, and I relate it to, well, the mass. This function reminds suspiciously of what things we do in quantum mechanics. If you write down a wave function or in Schrodinger equation, you write the momentum as the derivative of the wave function. So if I write the wave function as e to the is, I would have a very similar equation. Actually, the correspondence would even be better if I can replace what I call c by what I call v, velocity, because then there would be momentum here. Anyhow, the argument which I gave between this and getting the force is that the temperature I can write then as the Unruh temperature, and multiplying them will give me m times a. This surely works near horizons of black holes, but you would also say then it works for Rydland horizons. Indeed, it works for Rydland horizons. But the Rydland situation is quite special. There's also a puzzle which I have here. I'll be honest about that. The direction in which the gradient acts is the direction in which the force is acting. So I'm accelerating now in that direction, and then there will be a Rydland horizon on this side. But suppose I let the acceleration go to zero slowly, then the distance away from the Winkler horizon is actually it's inversely proportional to the acceleration. So the Winkler horizon will move away. But then if I change the sign of the acceleration, somehow the direction in which the gradient should act should somehow change time. Of course, that happens because the horizon also has to be sort of appearing on the other side. And I'm actually going to tell you there is a reason why we're going to now modify this, which you can think about in the following way. So this is going to be the proposal. Maybe I should have. Yeah. If we think about a mass being here, and then the horizon was where the escape velocity is equal to the speed of light. But in general, an equipotential surface, you can define an escape velocity in a different way by, express it in terms of the Newton potential. And indeed, I will tell you that the way I can do this, rescale my variables is precisely by replacing the speed of light by this escape velocity. And I'll give you an argument why this should. Actually, I have three arguments that work in favor of this. But this is anyhow the proposal. I'm actually missing this slide. Oh, I think I lost this slide. Yeah, maybe I'll mention this. Yeah, slightly look like this. In the sitter space, there's actually a similar story. Let me not try to do this anyhow. I lost it. There's something about an argument in the sitter space that also tells me that this is the right way to look at it. And you know, this remark, I think I should probably even skip. This is a summary. What's I'm doing with the time, by the way? Sorry?
About 10 minutes.
About 10 minutes. I have a part I want to add. Okay. Anyway, this is a summary of what I wanted to say about why I think gravity is emergent. At the microscopic scale, I think nature is described in many degrees of freedom, the precise nature of which and the dynamics should not be important, and that gravity indeed is sort of then the consequence of changing the amount of information. Well, given the fact that I have time, I actually will say something about the sitter case, which I lost on the slide. So the thing I mentioned about the Winkler horizon had to do with the Winkler horizon being infinite. So if you have a Winkler horizon, then if you have a particle that's being accelerated, the distance away from the horizon goes like c over c squared over the acceleration. Now, if I am in the sitter space also has the horizon. But that is a finite distance away. And if you would sit in the center of the sitter space, you would not experience a temperature. Sorry, you would not experience acceleration, but you do experience a temperature. Sort of a little bit of an embarrassment, because if you would say that I wrote the temperature before as, if I ignore now h bars and c's, as some acceleration over 2 pi. If I say that temperature is responsible for a force, and indeed I have a change in entropy, which is proportional to m, I mean, what I wrote before was that I had the acceleration, temperature times the change in entropy would give me F equals ma. But if I have already temperature in the sitter space, how do I get a force? I mean, then already we get a force immediately if this change of entropy would occur. I mean, it's also not clear in which direction the change of entropy would have to be written. in order to get the correct force in the sitter space, you have to think about what is the relationship between temperature and acceleration in the sitter space. So the Ungru formula has to be modified in the sitter space as follows. This is the Ungru temperature in the sitter space. So the sitter space already has a temperature when acceleration is zero. That's the temperature you would see in the middle of the sitter space. But if you start accelerating, you would see this temperature. With A0 equals 0, this would be the Ungru temperature. So what I need to do to sort of save that F equals MA, I need to write this as follows. Because then if I multiply the temperature with the change of an entropy, I would get the same law back again. I mean, you can do this in your head. So what is this factor which I write down here? Well, if you think about an accelerated observer in the sitter space, it would be the same as putting the observer slightly away from the center. Because if you have a static observer in the sitter space, so this is the static patch of the sitter space, an observer that's not at the center is actually being accelerated because it would like to sort of accelerate away from us. I mean, the sitter space is expanding. But if you want to keep it there, it has to accelerate towards us. So there's a certain acceleration which is related to the distance away from the origin. Actually, it's just the Hubble, well, there's a immediate law you can write down. But there's also a way you can then interpret what I've written down here. This doesn't work. I mean, I should put a C here in order to get the usual. Anyhow, the thing I've written down here is precisely a velocity that is associated to the redshift factor between the two observers, because the two observers in the sitter space will be redshifted with respect to each other. And it's precisely the same modification that I had before. And the nice thing now is that if you now think about how delta S of x behaves when you put A to 0, it will actually go to 0, and it will smoothly go to the other side. So I don't have this effect that I had in the sitter or in Rindler space, where I would have the gradient going this direction, and then suddenly it would sort of go in the other direction. In the sitter space, it works nicely because the horizon doesn't go to infinity like there. The horizon merges with the horizon of the sitter space. I mean, it is actually identified with the horizon of the sitter space if you accelerate.
Is there a way to interpret that additional acceleration in terms of another spatial dimension, which you then project out? Because, I mean, you've got Pythagoras' theorem right there for two orthogonal accelerations, right?
There's a derivation of this formula due to Desser and Levin. Yeah, all right. Anyhow, where they embed the sitter space in the. So if you think about the sitter space as being embedded, then you can think about the trajectories of observers in this bigger space.
Right.
And then it's the usual Ungru formula that will tell you precisely that.
Okay, cool. So as I recall, for anti-sitter, it is a square minus a naught square.
Yes.
It's a critical acceleration, right?
That's confusing, to be honest, yes. You're right. But it's true. I mean, that actually happens because there's not even horizon if you accelerate. It's only when you have a certain acceleration where you reach the boundary in a finite amount of time that you will have a horizon happening. So in the sitter space, any sitter space, that there would be a minus sign in this.
As far as I know, this room is not sitting near the surface of a black hole. It's far away from the horizon. So I ask my question again, how do you know the second or third of Aristotle's generally in this room?
First of all, we don't know we're not at the horizon of a black hole, to be honest.
Well, I think so.
Sorry?
I presume this is true, but I just think.
No, actually, I'm not making a joke. I mean, the point is that there's no way of telling that we're not at the horizon of a black hole. If there would be a huge black hole in the center of our galaxy, whose very big one, whose
Schwarzschild radius is so big that we would be crossing it right now, we would not notice. We would still be sitting here and saying the same thing and talking the same way, mm-hmm. and there's nothing different in the way we experience physics. So the arguments that I gave you, what happens at the horizon of a black hole, would still also apply here. Of course, only thing I have to tell, and I think that's very important eventually in how we're going to understand emergence of space, these things are dependent on the choice of observer. And actually, one of the things we learned about discussions about black holes is where a horizon is sitting and what's happening near the horizon and what description we're giving to it depends on who is looking at it and who is describing it. So I think eventually also in this whole story here, I also have to choose an observer to say that this is the horizon of the visitor space. So what I chose to be, even to define Newton's potential, there are ways I can do this by going to other coordinates and things like that, where I can reformulate what Newton's potential is. If I go to an accelerated frame, there would be an effective gravity, but it's something that would not be there if I would be just sitting still. So a lot of this depends on the choice of observers. But I don't think, by the way, that this is making it, no, actually it makes it subtle, because I think the emergence of space is something you have to think about from a certain perspective.
The coordinate time t.
Yes.
The horizon is in the virtually future light form. There's something in proper time that I can fall through the 15 hours.
Yes.
So I ask my question again.
So what is the precise question? Whether we should, how do I know where thermodynamics falls? That's what you're saying.
Yeah, the second law of thermodynamics is. Has to be true in this room, generally speaking.
If there would be an observer that would be accelerating away from us and doesn't even need to be very big acceleration, but then he could create what we call an oriental horizon right in this room. If that observer would do an experiment like the one I described, where he lowers a particle towards our horizon, he would be testing the force, the inertia, precisely that he needs to put on that string to see what that particle is doing. And he would conclude that's an entropic force.
Well,
it's simply because black hole horizons can be made anywhere. I mean, they're not special, and horizons can be made anywhere by accelerating. So whatever reason I find for the force near the horizon, and I know it has some microscopic dual description in terms of microscopic distribution, that do not know about space-time, and I understand it as an entropic force, then there will be an observer who can give the same explanation to the force in this one. The usual inertia law, F equals ma, he can give an entropic interpretation. Because in his description, this will be the boundary of his space-time. There will be nothing behind this, because this is what his horizon is. But anyhow, there are other ways of thinking about temperature, which I think I should pull. I mean, there's certainly, you should not think about the temperature notion that I've introduced here as the temperature that you can associate with anything that we have here in our, I mean, temperature of certain microscopic degrees of freedom that we are using to describe space-time. And I think a more precise statement of what if you want to make these things more precise, I think the entropic, of the Born-Oppenheimer way of thinking about the entropic force will eventually be more precise statement. And there you can introduce notions of what are temperature, which are basically related to the level spacing of energy levels. I mean, that's another reason why I actually wanted to change the temperature from the Unruh temperature. I got a question from Milgram, what was his name? Is his last? Anyhow, the person who modified Newtonian dynamics. He asked me, indeed, well, if gravity is caused by the Unruh temperature, the Unruh temperature for a planet that's rotating is the acceleration, basically the acceleration, it's V squared over R. But the time scale at which things are changing, namely the direction of the velocity, is just one rotation. So that's V over R. So there's actually a factor V. I mean, the time scale of the temperature, the Umlaut temperature, is very low. I mean, it's a very small temperature. And it can hard, it's very difficult to imagine how that can explain something rotating with a certain frequency, which is V over R. So I have to have indeed a higher sort of effective temperature, and that I get precisely by this factor.
By what factor, sir?
So, okay, so what I'm saying is that, and actually maybe that's why I will now go to these equations. So I'm saying that these equations have to be modified by something that's a function of the Newton potential, so it has to do with the escape velocity way to, but also the velocity you need sort of to go into a circular orbit. So I want to rescale what I call h bar by a v. How should I say this? I'm going to replace c by a v. And that's v over c. But if I multiply this by v over c to get the same Newton law, I have to divide that by v over c. So I'm raising the temperature, lowering the entropy gradient. The force is just a consequence of the product of both. So I can modify the one and the other. But then if the formulas look like this, and this actually is the circular frequency of motion if you go in orbit. And this is indeed the change actually in the action integral if you would go around. So now I've identified actually the action integral of an orbit with the entropy with it. So it has precisely the interpretation of level distances. If you think about this in a Bohr fashion, you would actually conclude the same thing. So there's even a formula in classical mechanics which tells you that the force, d equals omega dj. Omega being the rotation, the frequency of the motion, and j being the action interval around. And then the formula I have here is dds. So the dj is actually the action change, which is what I have here. So there's a way in which these formula will come together. So it's quite clear that the force laws can come up. So I believe these are the right formulas, but the reasoning doesn't change because anyhow this is an effective rescaling of Newton's of Planck's constant. I think I have a few things to say about string theory, but I'll actually postpone that for tomorrow.
Okay, questions. I think the tradition is that we turn to the students first and ask them.
If you consider two screens, typically like the horizon of a black hole and stretch horizon, or I don't remember how you called it, but this slightly larger horizon. Such that in between you have no mass, so just vacuum. Mm-hmm. The area of the two horizons are different.
Yes.
The areas are different. So you would expect the number of bits stored on both screens to be different. And so my question is, where are the bits of difference? Like in the space between the two screens, you would expect the bits corresponding to the difference of areas to live. You would expect the bits to be in between the two screens. So are they in the curvature, or are they?
The fact that we don't need information to describe empty space, I don't think is true. And so certainly, I mean, you're right. I mean, that the areas are different, so I have fewer degrees of freedom associated with them. But they're replaced then by the effective things that I do in the space in between. But there are still fields describing the other forces. There are still things that if I put something there, that it knows the relative distance away from other objects. So there's lots of information. There's more information contained in more space, because you can have the possibility of putting things there. But I must say, I mean, clearly, I mean, what I've done is still at the heuristic level, where there are many things to be understood at the conceptual level before trying to even answer these questions. I think eventually, when we understand it much better, some of the concepts that I've introduced may well appear approximate or even have been replaced by something else. So the screen, for instance, what I say, I think where they are precisely located may turn out eventually not a very precise question. I mean, there's a certain notion of integrating out degrees of freedom which are replaced by other things, but it's something that may not be an overly local picture like I have put it down here.
Yep. In the beginning of the talk, and in your paper as well, you mentioned that the microscopic theory knows about time. So, and in your derivation of Newton's law and so on, the screen seems to be a sphere in space.
Yes.
How would you sort of extrapolate this to world sheets and space-time surfaces? Does it extrapolate nicely?
I find emergence of time much harder, actually. I remember a discussion I had with Lee about this, but I find it a very hard concept to think about emergence of time. And as I said, I mean, I think when I do my reasoning, and I think it's very important, I always think about an observer. There's someone doing this testing. There's someone testing what the space. I mean, if you think about emergent space, you have to think who is trying to describe this microscopic dynamics in terms of space-time. You have to give that observer a location, and I think about time as the time of that observer. So there is some preferred reference frame to which you have to sort of go back to. I mean, that's also related to the questions that have been asked. I mean, there must be a starting point where you start from. Otherwise, it's very hard to get something out of nothing. I mean, so I think with time, I introduce, first of all, a concept where they can introduce like energy and so on. I mean, otherwise, I don't even know what a force concept is. I find it hard to do this without assuming emergence. I mean, okay, it can be more like a proper time or something like that, because eventually I would like to have, of course, that every observer, also boosted ones, can do the same thing. And so there must be some way in which Lorentz invariance is restored, at least that's what I believe in this picture.
But then why do we have 4D diffeomorphic invariance? Can you explain this in this picture?
Only if you assume that there's some uniform, I mean, some universal velocity by which information can travel. I mean, if you have something like the speed of light, and you have some Lorentzian signature, then one is okay. I mean, but to be honest, I don't have a good enough understanding to sort of see it completely. I mean, but I'm not worried that somehow this may not be consistent with it. I mean, I don't understand the Young covariance from the picture that I have, but I don't think that it will be inconsistent with it either.
So I guess John asked a question early on. So let's say it was a century ago, and somebody gave a talk that electromagnetism, Coulomb's law, is a thermodynamic, is an entropic force. So what did you on? What is your?
The indications we have in for gravity, which of course stronger, we already knew about relationships with thermodynamics. But I think the fact that energy plays a role and all the concepts that mean that any object has a gravitational force, I mean, the universality of gravity is a very important argument to sort of at least start with gravity from this perspective. But I do think, by the way, that also electromagnetic forces are emerging along a similar line. But then, of course, it cannot be as universal, because you have to explain why it's only charged objects that experience it. But I do more generally believe that forces, even what we call now fundamental, at a more microscopic level, are emerging. And actually, I'll talk about that tomorrow.
I have two small questions. In the third item, you say the cost. Is the cost in energy, in entropy, or what? And the second question, very short one, why is entropy such an important, prominent role here in your approach? Why not instead keep Gibbs potential? Why with chemical potential?
Well, chemical potential, of course, has a very, I mean, entropy for me measures the level of ignorance. And in a certain way, I think gravity for us is a big garbage box, garbage can in which we put all of our ignorance about the microscopic forces, and we call it gravity. That's really what this is about. I mean, there's lots of things going on which we don't understand, and we just put it all in one big garbage box, and we call it gravity. And I think that's why gravity is associated with entropy. There are a few things we understand of the microscopic forces, and those, I mean, at least in a slightly different way, we call those electromagnetism, strong interactions, and weak interactions. But they're maybe not even fundamental as well. But the biggest amount of things we don't know, we put it together, we call it entropy, and we call it gravity. That's really what the whole thing is about. I mean, gravity is a collection of many, many forces together, and which together behave like gravity. Many interactions or many dynamics together. So the fact that that's entropy is just the fact that that's expressing the fact that it is combining many things to be microscopic dynamics about which we are totally ignorant. And ignorance is expressed in terms of entropy.
So I understand we want to somehow put our thing ignorance about the microscopic space into the entropy. But I'm trying to understand why does photography play a very crucial role into understanding this?
Okay, it was clear from the talk. I had to assume holography to explain what the force law looks like. But I have a hope that eventually we understand where it comes from. But it's not like I already immediately can tell you this is what it is. But I think, no, it's clearly important. I mean, it tells us that by specifying everything on a surface, we don't lose any information about what's going on in the floor. And it may be just because of the fact that the field equations are elliptic equations that can be solved by putting boundary conditions on the boundary. I mean, that's a certain way how we understand it in ADS-CFT. There we know that we can relate boundary correlation functions to things in the boat by solving field equations. And the field equations just add one extra dimension. So, yeah. And certainly, in the way I use it here, the fact that I can put everything on a screen, just use the fact that there was a Laplace equation that determines the thinking potential. But clearly, I mean, that's things to be understood.
Yeah. I guess a pair of questions. The first is, when you're talking about a screen, is that supposed to be like nothing more than just a division? Like you have all of your microscopic degrees of freedom, and is a screen nothing more than just a division of the microscopic degrees of freedom into two piles?
That's basically what I said, but it's true. I mean, there's a way you have to partition your microscopic degrees of freedom or make it into some subsets where you can subsequently integrate them out, replace them by the other notion which you call space-time. And then just where you put that scale. I mean, actually, if I do it in the string situation, it's related indeed between where you go from an open string to a closed string picture. And that's determined by some parameter, which is not even location in space-time, but which probably translates into that. And so there is, indeed you're right, there is some formal way in which I distinguish, separate the microscopic degrees of freedom and the other one by some parameter which I look is associated with the location of the screen.
So, am I interpreting you right? But would it be accurate to say then a screen is something like you set up the screen by taking your whole microscopic system and then partitioning off part of it and replacing one part with like an effective microscopic description?
Yes.
Okay. And so the second question was, how do you? Is there like sort of a simpler way to understand what you mean by the distance of an object from a screen?
How I'm approaching it from the side where I already have replaced it with space-time notions. And so in the space-time, I have a notion of distance. But you're right, if I have to replace what I mean by the location by a screen by a more abstract notion of the sort that you said, then it doesn't have a very precise, I mean, it probably means something about the, I mean, in ADS-C, feet has something to do with the scale, for instance. I mean, it has just emerged, and it's on the edge of being either emerged or not emerged. I mean, there's a certain way that you are beginning to understand the degrees of freedom of that object in terms of space-time notion.
Yeah, I just want to ask a question about, I guess when you're doing quantum gravity, what you might want to do is quantum cosmology. So it seems like that's something that maybe you don't want, or you just not want to, but that you just want to have the possible region where space-time has already emerged, or in a separate region, or do you want to think of actually being able to do quantum gravity for the whole universe?
So if I think about quantum cosmology, I start thinking about quantum functions for the universe or something like that, and I don't like that so much. I hope, first of all, that this all has had lots to do with cosmology. I mean, certainly, I hope that that's an area where there will be applications. But I think our understanding or the way we should describe cosmology from this holographic perspective, we haven't completely understood yet. But I don't think we should try to do this in one big description, quantum description of the entire universe. And to me, that seems like too big an object to even start thinking about in terms of the full wave function of the universe. But of course, you would like to understand how space-time emerges. I mean, if you think how space-time emerges, then you're also asking the question, how does our universe, our picture of the universe, emerge from a more microscopic point of view? Anyhow, maybe we should discuss this further, because I think it's a big question that can have lots of discussions about.
You had a question already. I'll give the last question to Lee.
Okay, just following up on that. There's so many things to think and to ask about this, but it seems very tempting, given your last comment, to think that this process by which space emerged, moving inward, may be something that happened, and that may have characterized the early universe, that the emergence of the description of classical space from some other system, and maybe that has cosmological consequences.
I like to think that indeed the picture in which we think about emergent space will explain how we should look at our cosmological data. And but I'm not sure I would like to think about it as a dynamical process. I think emergence of space is not a dynamical process. Although, of course, what does happen is that if you think that the energies go down, then if space is a low energy phenomenon, then of course it's something that is more, well, we can think about it more in classical terms than if we would be in a high energy situation. But I think that the space-time picture, even of our universe, breaks down here.
Mm-hmm.
So from our perspective, there is nothing beyond the cosmological horizon. So I'm totally against the multiverse picture, which would associate lots of things beyond that, because I think that's where space-time doesn't exist anymore from our perspective. That could be complementarity. So every observer could put them there. Actually, I have a paper on this where I have in the sitter space precisely figured out how to do this. So where you patch together, you give every observer the right to describe the world, the universe in this way, but you also explain how to go from one observer to the other observer, doing Lorentz transformation, the sitter transformation. So there could be another observer that's accelerated, but another one who lives here. But there's some translation in which you can go from here to here. But each one of them, well, they only agree about this and to a certain degree, but what's happening here doesn't make sense there, and what's happening there doesn't make sense here.
Okay, well, there are a lot of stimulating ideas to discuss, and Eric will be around on Friday, and so I encourage you all to have lots of discussions. But let's thank him again for very...